Well, good morning, everybody. Glad you're here. I'm flying solo today. Steve's wife, Elena, is out of town, and so he has full-on children duty, and he's outnumbered. So he's wrangling some twins. He'd much rather be here, he assures me, but he's a good dad, watches those kids carefully. So we'll do our best to handle it this morning. As we get the gears turning, hopefully as the coffee begins to loosen some things up, think about a question for me. Who are you responsible for? In the course of your life, who has God put in it that you are responsible? This morning, Steve is responsible for those twins. Well, I think we start there. Certainly. And a lot of people don't get past that, right? The one person God says you really got to keep a handle on is you. Above all things, you are responsible for you. But as we grow, as we get into, like David and Saul, the anointing idea that God has a purpose, a mission, a goal for you in life, he does tend to put other people in your path. And he hopes, I think more than that, commands that we be responsible for them. When you have a family, obviously, as the dad, as the husband, you are responsible. You need to take care of them. I think as we take job roles, we take leadership roles, you all know this, we are responsible for them. We're going to see develop in the rest of David's life kind of this subtle theme that becomes very pronounced towards the end, but I wanted to introduce it here, that you're responsible for other people. If David is to be the king, who's he responsible for? Yeah, pretty much the nation. Saul is supposed to be responsible for them now, and he's doing a terrible job, but even David will struggle with this. And I think it's true of all of us. We don't always want everybody else's baggage, everybody else's responsibility. And there's probably certainly an art in not taking on the responsibility of other people that God hasn't given you. But we should never probably shirk our duty that when God calls us, especially as men, we have responsibilities. And what happens to other people depends on us. One of the truly sobering things that you'll see in Samuel is that God expects and sometimes won't intervene when we're supposed to be responsible. There's a classic story, and we'll do this in a couple of weeks, but Israel loses the ark, right? So it's a big battle. It'll be kind of a turning point for us. And the Philistines take it. And they very quickly decide, we don't want any part of this thing. We don't know what it is, but it's killing people. So they decide to give it back. And David organizes the wagon to bring it back. During the course of its transport, it starts to slip. Now this is a acacia wood box covered in gold leaf. It's hundreds of years old at this point. It's got to be very, very fragile. And so as it starts to fall off the wagon, you guys know this, a guy reaches out to try to keep it from falling. Well, he's not a priest. He's not cleared to touch it. And so he dies. And we're left with this big question mark. I mean, God, really? You killed a man for trying to protect you? I mean, sure, he broke some arcane rule about not being ritually clean and not being a priest and all of that. And we sort of scratch our heads and move on from that story. But what it was really establishing is sort of a warning for David. That's right. David was responsible for organizing the priests in a way that they could transport that thing safely. If they were moving a nuclear reactor and they didn't do their homework, people are going to die. It was the same way with the ark. This is a holy emblem of God. It's a It's a seal covenant kind of thing, and it is not to be played with. God is, his nature is not going to change because we decide we don't want to follow the rules one day. And all of that really is what's beginning here. David, other people's lives depend on what you do. And you expect me always to come and cover up your mistakes? It doesn't work that way. If you're going to learn the consequence of your choice, then sometimes you have to experience the consequences of your choice. So help me watch for this, who David is responsible for, who Saul is, and always thinking about who we are. But we're going to pick up in chapter 20. We sort of left off with David and Jonathan conspiring together to figure out if Saul really does want David dead. And that's not really a question in anybody's mind except for Jonathan. And the poor guy really seems to love his dad. He does love David. And he's made promises, covenants with David. But they decide to hide David from the new moon festival. And all these little historical details are kind of fascinating to me. We'll see another in a minute. So God commanded certain holidays, certain behaviors. And then we read about how the people acted. And there's not always a direct correlation. There's not really a celebration of new moon festivals. Not really in the law. So this is something else they've added on. But we do know one of the greatest signs of wealth in the ancient world was what you wore and what you ate. Now, this is chasing rabbits, but one of the coolest studies I ever got to do in graduate school at the University of Memphis was look at a research program based on bones for consumption of food. And the whole study put together a range of what people tended to prefer to eat and then generally what they ate. And so it starts off with, you could probably guess it, beef. No matter who you were in the ancient world, from Egypt to Rome to Greece to Persia, if you could have beef, beef was the way to go. And it went downhill quickly from there. Number two tends to be pork. It can be number two, number three, but pork, sheep after that, geese or some kind of fowl. Chicken comes relatively late, so they didn't actually calculate that in. And then you get into goats and fish. Nobody likes to eat fish. Fish is at the bottom. Fish is what your wife makes you eat when your cholesterol is too high. That's been universal in the ancient world. So one way the king would always show his wealth and his power was inviting you to eat. So missing a chance to eat meat, and the average ancient is not eating meat regularly. It's going to be during festivals. It's going to be during holidays. So we can, where do I want to pick up? Let's pick up verse 25. So 20 of 25. So Jonathan, verse 25, sat at his usual place against the wall with Jonathan. Saul sat against his usual place against the wall. So again, reinforcing his paranoia, right? Nobody can get in behind me. And Jonathan sitting opposite him. And Avner beside him. David's place was empty. Saul didn't say anything about it that day. For he said to himself, something must have happened to make David ceremonially unclean. Yes, that must be why he's not here. But when David's place was empty the next day, so how long does this feast go on? At least 2 days. When's the last time you were at a party that was getting started on the second day? You were a lot younger, I can tell. But that's a lot of meat, and that's a lot of drink. The Hebrews have it well, or the Israelites at this point. They're wine drinkers. Most of the ancient Near East drinks beer. Its grain is a lot more accessible, but Israel has a natural supply. It's one of their main crops is grapes. So what does a lot of wine do to you the second day? Not good things. So the second day, David's not there. Saul asked Jonathan, "Why hasn't the son of Jesse been here for dinner, either yesterday or today?" Jonathan replied, "David earnestly asked me if he could go to Bethlehem." Which this is a nice little reference here. What's Bethlehem to David? That's a hometown. Obviously, who will come from Bethlehem much, much later? Yeah, Jesus. So the name itself is interesting. Bet Lechem, so it's the house of life or house of bread. And that's kind of an intended play on words. It's Kansas of ancient Judah. You get up in the mountains and they sort of level off finally and it's just flat and obviously filled with grain fields in ancient days. So David wanted to go home, supposedly, to offer sacrifice with his family. He wanted to take part in the family sacrifice. His brother demanded that he go there. So I told him he could go. That's why he isn't here. And this, of course, was the test. If Saul got upset, was mad, this would be an indicator to Jonathan and David that Saul had something planned, i.e. continuing his attempts to kill David. Sure enough, verse 30, Saul boiled with rage at Jonathan. "You stupid son of a whore." Have you ever said that? I mean, I don't really want to know, but you just gotten so angry, you had to say to your own son, "By the way." Yeah, that's... Yeah, see, and that's where, not that I'm some grand biblical translator, but man, we sanitize scripture a lot. Perverse woman, I'm sure that's what Saul said in a fit of rage, "You offspring of a perverse woman." Yeah. Again, no matter how many adjectives you add to her, she's still a whore. So, or that's the accusation. So, but obviously, this is a huge, huge line that we've crossed. Does Saul have a responsibility to his son? Obviously, and I think it works both ways. Jonathan is trying to respect his father, trying to make something good out of this whole mess, but Saul continually does this to himself. He tries to force an issue, tries to kill David, tries to really defy God. And remember last time he did it, he tried to take David from the prophets. Remember, his men kept prophesying, so he goes until he prophesies and rolls around naked. He's humiliated. So at this big new moon festival, when you're showing your power, your wealth, you're feeding all of your men, you're, again, reinforcing those bonds of loyalty, you've just made a scene when you said to a son what no father should say to a son. You're humiliating yourself. This insecurity that you have is being fed by you. You're the one that throws gas on this fire. "Do you think I don't know that you want David to be king in my place, shaming yourself and your mother?" This is obviously getting to the issue. This is getting into what Saul fears above all things. "As long as that son of Jesse is alive, you will never be king. Now go and get him so I can kill him." So if there was any doubt in Jonathan's mind that his dad was one, unhinged, and two, just obsessed, Saul serves as a great warning for all of us. Hate can eclipse everything else in your life. And I don't say that in a Pollyanna kind of way. You know, oh, love in your heart. But have you guys ever known people like that? Or maybe, I know my own life, that's seeped in a little bit. You just get so angry at something that it begins to overshadow what you have with your family, overshadow the relationship you have with God. I mean, I worry about our culture today because all we do is go for the jugular, right? I mean, there's no live and let live, no harm, no foul, let's move on. I mean, we go for it. You should lose your job, you should... And this is hate. It just, there are things that we're supposed to hate, and there's evil that we're supposed to face down, but it can't become you. It can't eat you up. And Saul is just, what's the old saying? David is living in Saul's head rent-free. I mean, that's all that's in there. There's no Jonathan. There's no family. So what do you do as a son? You're Jonathan, you're there. Your dad's gone. He's weakening the kingdom every day. What do you do? Now the commandments tell you, honor your mother and father. This society is one that really, really respects older parents and the patriarchs. But who should Jonathan's ultimate loyalty be to?
To his father, but he knows his dad's kind of going to the top floor.
Yeah. It's really hard when your parents lose their faculties. Have any of you been there? I'm sure some of you have. If not, I pray God always keep you from that. My mother, before she died of MS, lost her faculties. MS is a horrible, horrible disease that affects all sorts of parts of your body, sort of random nerve endings that it'll attack. And so she got so mean in the end. I couldn't take my son around her. She'd scream and just horrible things. That's still your mom, you know? That's the woman who gave birth to you, held you, loved you. Jonathan is in a horrible place here. I think above just about anybody of these characters we've looked at, Jonathan gets God is the one we owe loyalty to, first and foremost. God is the one that put Saul in power. He's forgotten it. God is the one that's putting David in power. And what an incredible man to be able to say, hey, it's not about me. I'm willing to step aside from becoming the leader of the country to support the person that I think God is really anointed for this. But when you face resistance from this idea from your own father, who is, let's be honest, he's homicidal, isn't he? I mean, he's tried to kill David probably more fingers than I have on my hand. You can probably guess what happens next. What does Saul always seem to have with him? A spear. It's not in his underwear. He's at dinner, but he came to the dinner table with his gun. No, totally unrelated. Do you eat your macaroni and cheese with your gun?
I don't eat macaroni and cheese.
Okay, but you take your gun to your table. Well, sure enough, Saul boiled with rage. Let's see. But what has he done? Jonathan demanded. Why should I put him to death? Then Saul hurled his spear at Jonathan, intending to kill him. I have thought about killing my teenager, but I've never actually acted upon it. And it wasn't for anything like this. But wow. He's not good at it. He really is. Maybe everybody thought, you know, we should get dad glasses. On second thought, no, we really shouldn't get dad glasses. He can maybe kill somebody. So at last, Jonathan realized that his father really was determined to kill David. Jonathan left the table in fierce anger and refused to eat all that day, for he was crushed by his father's shameful behavior towards David. Again, I almost wish this guy had become king. God knew, and there were parts of David that we still see today in the Psalms, but David brought this out of Jonathan, and he was a righteous guy. You guys know how Jonathan dies? With his father by his side, trying to defend him to the end. It's hard when your parents lose it. He does. But again, I think Jonathan's this perfect little example. How do you support your parents without letting their choices hurt other people?
In a weird way, it still shows the loyalty that David had to Saul. When Saul and Jonathan died, how vengeful he was on what he did to kill our brother.
It's true, yeah. How does David express love? Yeah. Killing people who mess with you. But. Has anybody ever had to take keys away from their parents to drive? That's not fun. I had to take my mom to the nursing home. Her whole life, she didn't want to go to the nursing home. And again, she was right on the cusp of losing her faculties. And so my dad had said, you're going to rehab. One of the rehab facilities in the nursing home. And so he said, you're going to ride over with your mom. Suddenly my family's gone. Where's everybody? And that was hard, hard. I mean, my mom, I could see it when she figured it out what was happening. This is the woman that took me to school. The one that made lunches for me. And here I am putting her in a nursing home. But who do you have responsibility for? And where does that accountability really go to? If I could change anything about the way Christians see their spirituality, it would be get back to a point of accountability. We need to remember we're accountable to God for what we do. Not just the people around us, although our responsibility for them doesn't go away. Jonathan is doing it all right here. He's not letting his father get away with this killing of David, but he's also not abandoning his dad. 35, the next day, as agreed, Jonathan went out into the field and took a young boy with him to gather arrows. Start running, he told the boy, so you can find the arrows as I shoot them. So the boy ran, and Jonathan shot an arrow behind him. When the boy had almost reached the arrow, Jonathan shouted, "The arrow is still ahead of you. Hurry, hurry, don't wait." So the boy quickly gathered up the arrows and ran back to his master. He, of course, didn't understand what Jonathan meant. Only Jonathan and David knew. So this was the prearranged signal. We think, this is sort of a play on words. I'm sure you've been taught this since you were young. What's the biblical definition of a sin? No, it's deeper than that. It's missing the target, yeah. So that seems to be what they're playing off of. The Greeks actually call it harmatia, which is missing. When you shoot with a bow and you aim at a target and you miss it, that's what the Greeks call sin. Hebrew has a little bit of this as well. So this seems to be what they were after. This was the sign for David that Saul is really ready to sin, which is to kill you. But then, verse 41, they meet up. As soon as the boy was gone, David came out from where he was near the stone pile. Then David bowed to Jonathan with his face to the ground. So this is the most extreme version of reverence you can show somebody else. The Egyptians actually call it eating dirt, which I like. You get your face in the dust. Both of them were in tears as they embraced and said goodbye. Especially David. At last, Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we've made a pact in the Lord's name. We have entrusted each other and each other's children into the Lord's hands forever." And David left, and Jonathan returned to the city. So they're friends. They're real buddies in a sense, the deepest sense of that word. who is David responsible for now? Yeah, Jonathan and his family, certainly. So again, you don't have to make these vows, these promises to God. But when we do, we need to keep them. And we'll look at how David keeps them or doesn't keep them. But Jonathan's willing to do that as well. He is going to do everything he can to protect David. And David doesn't have any children at this point, but to protect David's line. In a sense, I think this is where God really, really teaches us. There's that great question with Cain and Abel, am I my brother's keeper? And there are times in which you do become your brother's keeper, whether it's a brother of blood or a brother of soul like David and Jonathan. So what does David do now? What do you do? You know, without a doubt, Saul is going to kill you and continue to try to kill you until you're dead. What do you do? Yep, where do you go? Mountains? He does, yeah. He likes hiding in Judah. Is this the first time he's had to run away? Where did he go last time? Yeah, he goes to the priest this time, but where did he go last time? Remember, he went to see the prophet Samuel? And what happened when Saul tried to get him? Yeah, he was protected, right? There was that sort of divine firewall. Every time Saul tried to send troops in to get him from the prophets, this weird thing goes on. And so it's really, really strange as to why David doesn't go there. He knows he was safe there. Instead, he goes, chapter 21. David went to the city of Nov to see Ahimelech, the priest. Ahimelech trembled when he saw him. Why are you alone? He asked. Why is no one with you? The only guess I can give you as to why David goes here and not to back to Samuel is that this is towards his home. This is towards Bethlehem. It's south. There is no temple at this point. They just have the tabernacle, which is a fancy way of saying a tent. So this is the tent that Moses built. They move it around. It has basically three sections. It's sort of a long rectangular section. Well, do you guys remember when we set one up here in the parking lot? We need to do that again. It's just a big tent that holds the ark. And so they'll offer sacrifices there. So it moves around. It's at Nov now. The priest is afraid when he sees David alone. Why do you think he's afraid? Who is David? Yeah, he probably can figure out David's on the run. David is one of the leading officials in the country now. He travels with an entourage, usually. He has his men with him, usually. Or certainly, if the king sent him out on a mission, he would have guards with him, advisors, courtiers, that kind of stuff. So David doesn't show up, announced. He doesn't call ahead. He just shows up one morning at your doorstep. And what does David do? The king has sent me on a private matter, David said. He has told me not to tell anyone where I am. I have told my men where to meet me later. Now, what is there to eat? Give me 5 loaves of bread or anything else you have. All right, you're the priest. David showed up. No announcement, no, hey, get ready to receive an emissary of the king, no guards. David doesn't have any food. Keep it all shh, shh, hush, hush. You know what's going on, right? The priest isn't stupid. What did David just do? Yeah. But what did he just do to the priest? Yeah, he lied to him. What do you think Saul is going to do if he finds out this priest helped David? Yeah, we're back to the spear again. In fact, I'll jump ahead a little bit. Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. You got about a 50-50 chance of getting in trouble. Saul actually kills this priest, all the priests that were there, 83 of them, and then he goes and kills their entire families. So he doesn't do it. He sends his men to do it. Obviously, this is a tremendous, tremendous sin. Now, all sin is sin, but to slaughter God's priests as they're performing a duty is again, a line that no one should ever cross, let alone the king. But Saul is running across these lines really, really regularly. And the thing that is being introduced here is that this all is also on David. Who are you responsible for? David wants right now to be responsible for himself. And he just wants to escape. There was a place that he could have gone where we assume the protection would have continued. But instead, he's kind of striking out on his own. And a lot of people are going to suffer. A lot. Now, if David had learned the lesson here, and it's a pretty big lesson, a lot of lives lost, his life would have been totally different. But he doesn't. It's a hard lesson. When you involve other people, when you are a leader, God has put you in that position. God expects you to be responsible for those people. David, right out of the gate, is asking for bread. Can you sort of get the significance of that? What is it to give somebody bread? It's life. Give us this day our daily bread. Give us this day our daily life. The Romans have a great saying, the man that gives you your bread owns you. Now, this is part of the circus and bread business that the Roman emperors do, but there is this real sense, if you take a God-appointed leadership position and people are trusting you, you ought not to get them killed. You ought not to do things that are harmful, damaging to them. You are responsible for them. So, what kind of bread are the priests going to have available to them? Yeah. Which, yeah, it's not usually the most tasteful thing in the whole world. So, when God set up his temple or his tabernacle, there were a couple of things that you sort of had to do for God every day. You had incense that you brought. There were animals that were sacrificed. But there was this table called the showbread. And there was a loaf of bread that was made every day, but they would rotate them out. So they would sit there for a little bit. But it was made not by the priests themselves, but by people bringing it in. And this stood for the life of Israel. So there's 12 loaves. So this is sort of like communion bread. This is holy bread. It's not supposed to be used by the priests at all. So verse 4, we don't have any regular bread, the priest replied, but there is holy bread. Again, holy meaning it's set apart. This is bread, in a sense, for God. So other pagans and stuff, they think they feed the gods. Like the Egyptians, every morning they have breakfast for the god and lunch and dinner. And it's the whole, if the god can have as much as he wants, and then when he's done, we get the leftovers. Huh, he didn't eat very much today. And then, of course, they all eat. It didn't quite work that way in Israel. This bread really was a symbol, like I said, the life that was before God. So it was supposed to stay out there. It wasn't meant for consumption. But this priest says, I guess you can have it if your young men have not slept with any women recently. And this is one of those weird things that they throw in. So yeah, that would make them ritually impure. When are Israelite men not supposed to sleep with other women? When they're at war. And look at David's response. Don't worry. I never allow my men to be with women when they are on a campaign. Talk about words that are come back to bite him in the butt. His men go out on campaign and he stays home because he don't want to go to war anymore. And that's when he sees Bathsheba. So the priest is trying to, I think, come up with a half excuse here. These men never should have been given the bread, but they didn't have anything else. So he's trying to make sure, well, hopefully they're not completely contaminated. Also, priests during their time of service, if they're Levites, will not have relations with women. So they're trying to match that. But obviously, they're bending the rules here in order to help David. They see a man in need, and they're giving him literally the life that they have. So we're going to run out of time. I'm going to stop here. We'll pick up of what happens. Just like a movie, David is scarfing down the bread, and he says, do you have a gun? Just any kind of gun? Actually, it's a weapon. Do you have any kind of weapon? And they just happen to have the sword of Goliath, which David had probably turned in as sort of a spoils of war, something to keep in the tabernacle as a thank you to God that they won the war. So the priests are going to give life, bread, to David, and they're going to give him a sword. They've armed him, and they've given him life. So it's going to go badly. So any questions? Got through it pretty quickly. Think about it today. Who am I really responsible for? Myself? That's a hard one. My family? As you begin to understand the role that God has put you in life, I think you can sort of triangulate that with the people that depend on you not to get them into trouble, not to lead them into a place that's harmful, not to lead them in a place where they're going to dishonor or have to forsake God. And I still think it's great to hold out Jonathan. Incredible guy. And may we all do so well as to have the eyes to see where God is really blessing, where God is really working, and to help that along, even if it's not to our own benefit. So let's pray. Father our God, thank you that this life is a lot of what we make it. You certainly have plans for us. You've given us abilities. You allow us to have experiences. But then you give us the ability to choose. Will we seek the path that you've set before us? Or will we allow our anger, our hatred, our emotions, our fear to drive us off of that? We thank you that you continue to put people in our lives that can teach us. People that can teach us about you. We give you thanks that you also have given us a world that we are to seek dominion over. The animals are not supposed to rule over us. We're supposed to rule over them. We're supposed to create a life from the ground, create a world. And in that, you bring us people, O Lord, people who we're responsible for. Help us to look through those eyes today, to do our best to be a true example of you, to know ultimately you take responsibility for us. We're just creatures. We're just that life which you made. But you've said that we are your own children. You've said and shown us that you will die for us. May we emulate that. May we be about your work as we become our brother's keeper. Help us. In your son's name we pray. Amen.